But as we go through this, and please talk about the parallel, a person named Marge that served and taught and died. And as we go along these parallel facts, Lazarus, Lazarus' family, he was encountered in his pastoral care strategy. But we do some other stories on it, about what not only we saw in Marge, but learned from her. It may connect with some of the stuff that we've already encountered. And I'm hoping enough connections happen that you'll be able to say, you know, as we learn about this thing called death, people die. There are ways to keep the focus on, as the title says, it is for God's glory. A cut-rate casket maker had never moved to our town. A couple of years ago, he was not received well. He advertised in the paper that caskets that could be bought at the local funeral home for $5,000 were available through him for $2,500. He did not deliver, so he had to go get it with a pickup truck. The local funeral directors were not pleased. Any funeral directors yet? And since I worked with most of them in our area, I asked them about that, and they said, well, it isn't that we're being undercut in price. But they said there's just something wrong with taking such a cold and cheap look at death. Because people want to make sure that when death occurs, they do what is right. And sometimes that is in remembering the deceased, their mother, their father, their spouse, their children, with some tangible and significant service which does justice to the mother's memory. And one guy said, and you can't do that if you take the casket home in a pickup truck. Well, can you or can't you? Well, Jesus didn't even have a pickup truck in John 11, but he had some powerful things to say, not about the form, but about the substance of what it is that the people of God deal with people who die. My father passed this story on to me. He's been in ministry 60 years now. He's retired, but still preaching almost every Sunday up in Michigan, and then comes down to escape the sleet and the snow in Florida with us occasionally. Early in his ministry, he was at a pastoral conference on the west side of Michigan, and as the conference was going on, a young fellow, new in the ministry, one of the youngest guys at the conference, got up and started to leave. He was packing, as you know, packing his papers and all, and this crusty old veteran of the cross looked at him and said, where are you going? And he said, well, I just received word that one of our members is extremely ill and near death, and I just need to go home. And the old pastor looked at him and said, well, that happens. And he said, why are you leaving? And he said, I just told you. He was a little impatient. He said, I told you that I need to go home. One of my members is sick and near death. Well, he said, that happened. The old guy said, how long have you been pastor there? And the guy said, well, I've been there 3 or 4 years. And the old veteran looked at him and said, you need to tell me that you've been a pastor there 3 or 4 years, and your people don't know how to die. What kind of pastor are you? I told that story to my staff, and two of them were really offended. They said, what kind of pastor is that? Those of us who are clergy know what it is to feel sometimes really reactive when crises and death occur. We'd say, well, we really kind of, at least at first blush, give Jesus an F for his pastoral responsiveness. Because as the story unfolds, he didn't just pack his bags and sail over to Bethany. And this is not an examination of whether you go or whether you don't go. Because what Jesus is going to do is to tell us that as we work with people who die, it is always for the glory of God. 13 days ago, we heard, I think, in Mark's Gospel, he is risen, just as he told you. And those of us who preached that, and those of us who heard that, can remember the times in Jesus' ministry when he continually had to remind his disciples of why he had come, where he was going, and why he was going there. And so it was not a surprise, it wasn't one level of horrendous surprise and fright, when Jesus rose from the dead, because Mark ends, at least the one ending of Mark, in verse 8, trembling and astonished, they said nothing to anyone, because they were afraid. That's where verse 8 ends. It was a terrible fright to know that there is life after death, that he is risen. But on another level, the lost. It had been so long that people had forgotten that it had been lost. Can you imagine that? They had forgotten the book of the law, and they didn't even know what it was until Josiah started it. What did he do? He started reading it again. Passover. How often was Israel to celebrate Passover? Once a year. How often? Or ever. Why? People forget. They need to be told about God's mighty acts. In Jesus' ministry, in threefold passion prediction, he keeps telling the disciples in more intensive form what he's going to do, who's going to be involved. The bold of death. And the image I always have of the disciples after the third one, which is going to happen right after John 11, is of a bunch of school kids, or maybe a bunch of little kids, following their parents to the doctor for their first inoculation. They sort of know what's there, and they know it's going to be good for it, but they're not too crazy about the whole process. Jesus predicts, and then the angels say, as he has told you. Now, what I've done here is I've chopped up John 11 into a bunch of pieces, and I'm not going to read all of this to you. I'm going to comment about it, and the bold-faced things in the center are key words that I've inserted, and I've bold-faced some things in the paragraphs to kind of see the progression of Jesus' pastoral care strategy. I've gone through, I think, over 200 funerals in my career as a Lutheran pastor. When I saw the title here and it said, The Art of Dying, I wondered about that because some of the encounters I've had with families haven't had much art to them. Others have. They range from the committal, the graveside scene in inclement weather, to the corpse, the funeral director, and me in attendance. They range from that to full military honors at Arlington Cemetery. Bands, troops, caisson, cannon fire, the whole nine yards. Now, what is the art, you know, in those two things? A third example, a suicide that I buried some years ago. He was mentally ill, had had a history of depression, and had tried several times. This time he did. Was in the house 4 days before he was found, as Lazarus was in the tomb 4 days before Jesus' miracle. And people were so angry about what had happened that there were fist fights in the parking lot of the funeral home the night of the visitation. The siblings of this kid never got along that well, and this death did not bring them together. It only made them angrier. It is the only time in my life that I called a meeting of the family, the funeral director, before the funeral, and they were sitting in his office seething, and I said to them, my goal, first of all, is to get through the next 30 minutes without me beating each other up. Now, is that a pastoral act or a pastoral comment? But I said, the other thing that we need to deal with here, you will never know why this occurred, because that is in Jimmy's consciousness alone. We need to deal with how God reaches out to people who are hurting, who are estranged, and trying to bring some sort of sense about what all this might mean. The scene of Lazarus, wonderful story, begins with Jesus being made aware that Lazarus is ill. And already we have a hint in verse 4 when Jesus talks to those around him. His illness doesn't lead to death, it's for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Marge, the other teacher for us today, was one of these great, great ladies of the congregation. She was always available and had a bout with breast cancer 10 or 15 years earlier. She was one of these, a true and wonderful character. We ate dinner with her early as we got to know her, and she said, well, is everything okay? And we, of course, complimented her on the meal. And she said, well, she laughed. She said, I always have to ask because I have no taste. And, of course, her home was very artistically decorated. And I said, well, it seems to me you've got lots of taste. Well, she said, I can't taste. There's something is there. Her taste and smell is impaired. And we assured her that it was fine. She was the one who always kind of around helping out. One Sunday school program, I remember one kid who threw up at the chancel of our church because he got a little too upset about whether he remembered his lines or not. We had a kid lined up in small chairs, you know, facing the congregation, and Marge was hastening down the side aisle, and she got a hold of the kid just as he erupted and aimed him in such a way that it hit the tile rather than the carpet. And we chuckled about that. Of course, the parents of the kid were embarrassed to death, but Marge was a veteran grandmother and calmed them down too. And she said to me, well, I can't taste. but I could see, I could tell colors. And I saw the kid turning green, and she thought I'd probably get to the bathroom before he, you know, upshot. But she had the kind of presence that, you know, you could say, wow, that's really interesting. And so one day, she called me up and said, I want to come by and see you. And so she did. And we talked, and she said, I just found out that my cancer has recurred, and the doctor has told me that there's really nothing but a matter of time. I forgot whether it was pancreatic or liver cancer. It was something that gradually, as the disease took its course, it would not be terribly painful, but it would be just completely irreversible. And so, after the initial shock of that, being made aware, she said something very interesting. She said, you know, Pastor, as I go through this, you know, my faith is firm. But she said, I want to make sure that God is glorified in these next months. And what a juxtaposition to what Jesus is announcing. She wasn't aware of, I think, cognitively aware of God, let alone she knew the story. But what a neat statement for a child of God to say, I would like, you know, that God could be glorified wherever these next months lead. Most of us, when we get a notification like that, someone seriously ill, would respond as we expect. Martha, she shows up shortly. Don't you sit there, Pastor? Why don't you do something? Why don't you do something about it? Oh, sure. Do something about terminal illness. Do something about someone who's died in a traffic accident, or who's committed suicide, or died before their time. When you deal with being made aware of death, what comes over all of us is an overwhelming feeling of hopelessness and helplessness. Humanly speaking, face it, if you minister to people who die, anybody here not know that? When you minister to people who die, one of the first things you get in touch with is your own mortality. Awareness. Now, we'll move on to preparation. He calls the disciples together and he comments about this thing. He proposes a trip. They and I, darkness, are like, let's go to Judea again. The disciples say, wait a minute. Not a good idea, not a good career move. They kill people there. Jesus isn't worried about that. What he does say is he talks about those who walk in darkness, that they don't stumble because they see the light of the world. Those who walk at night stumble because the light is not in them. The Secret Service would never send a political figure, a president, or a lesser luminary into a place like Judea if they knew there was a security risk. It just wouldn't happen. It's normal human consideration that the disciples decide not to do that. It's best if you stay away. But then Jesus said, this is not a matter of his own safety. Where he is going, consonant with that God will be glorified, is that he is going as the light. And he's hoping that people will see that light. One of Martha's sons was not only apathetic, but antagonistic toward the Christian faith. He had gone through confirmation class and all of those things that parents do for their kids, and sometimes kids think that parents do to their kids. He had a background, but had gone from that to just an antagonistic relationship with the church and would have absolutely nothing to do with that. And Marge said, I realize the forces that are with him, but she said, I don't know what is going to happen. And I said, Marge, I don't either. What I do know is that you have planted the seed, and the Spirit has worked through you as a loving parent, and I'm content, as we said some weeks ago, to see where God will lead us in all of this thing. The next step of Jesus' journey, he has to deal with denial and defiance. Denial and defiance. Look at what the response is when he talks about Lazarus falling asleep. Can you almost hear the sigh of relief from the disciples' voice? We can understand that. He'll wake up, right? The tests are going to be okay, aren't they, Pastor? But I'm sure everything will be fine. And then you pray with someone, or you talk with someone as a fellow brother or sister in Christ, and you pray for them, and then sometimes the conversation still ends with, well, what will be, which is the call of faith. The latter is faithism. The former is, in God's hand, what will be. And to commend it to his care and keeping. Jesus speaks in words. His followers will know when he talks about sleep and awakening. But then you think about how much of our assumptions about pastoral care to people who are in crisis or who are ill are pretty well slanted toward getting well. What in fact, time will come for each of us. When humanly speaking, physically speaking, we won't get well. We will face the last dollar under. And the issue then is not to say, well, God, then you let me down. But how will we deal with those as they walk their journey of pilgrimage through this world toward eternity? There's a great story about a young pastor who went to the hospital. He had heard that one of his members was near death, and got up there in the hospital room when he got there, and she was there, really not terribly conscious, kind of lying in bed, half asleep, and a little saliva kind of draining from the side of her mouth, and breathing intermittently and heavily, and it was by all visible accounts close to her last hour. And so, being young, he didn't know exactly what to say. And he walked up and took her hand, because he had learned that in the seminary, and he talked with her and prayed with her, and he said, "Dear God, you know, if it is your will, you know, please reach out to Dora and restore her to health and to her home and her family, or prepare her for the life which is to come, you know." And he stopped the man, as he said, the Lord's Prayer finished. And he looked down, and Dora's eyes opened up, and she started breathing regularly, and wiped her mouth off, and wiped it on the pillow, and sat up, put the rail down the bed, sat up and stretched, and looked around, and looked at him, and said, "I feel wonderful. In fact, I've never felt this like this in the last 12 years. And she got up out of bed, and walked down the hall, and greeted the nurses, and they were astounded. This is a powerful story. They were astounded that what she had said. And she was discharged that day and went home. And the young preacher walks out of the room in shock and goes down to his car, opens the door, and used the wrong key first to find the guy in there, and sat down and bowed his head and looked up and said, "Lord, please don't do that to me again." A 5-year-old kid, airlifted from Germany to Walter Reed Hospital. Massive tumor on his left shoulder. Inoperable, malignant. Friends of theirs called me to drive an hour to Walter Reed, and I was said that was a 4-hour visit, 1 hour up, an hour to find the patient, and then the visit, and at least an hour back, and of course, if semis wrecked on the beltway, it would be another hour in instead. I got there, walked into the room, and the kid in bed looked exactly like our 5-year-old son. Had the same shade of pajamas on, same colored eyes. And I walked in and I almost fell over, literally, because the transference was almost more than I could stand. Went in, prayed with them, and it was an anguishing sort of thing. And went home, and the surgery was on Good Friday. And that day, they called that afternoon and said, "There is no cancer." I said, "I can't believe it." And they said, "We can't either. We had 4 different 7 tests, several different doctors look at them, and they said, it's gone. It's gone. And there is absolutely no medical explanation." So, you know, on one hand, we're going to do that to me. And the other thing, and you know the stories too, this one is not apocryphal. I was there, and I think, whoa. That happens too. Well, really, you know, the story that happened with Lazarus, even though he was dead, already dead. Anyway, even with denial and defiance, you know, the people who will talk about this, you know what Jesus said, "Lazarus is dead for your sake. I'm glad I wasn't there, so that you might believe." But let's go to him. Okay, let's go to him and get there. And Martha's other son-in-law, married to her daughter, of course, is a clergyman. And for the first several months of her last illness, he lived in what I call theological denial. He said the right things, but most of his conversation did not acknowledge that she was going to die. "She'll be fine," he kept saying. And he was looking for her to get better. Look at what Thomas's approach to it when he's confronted with the journey to Judea. "Let's go." Remember Thomas, the guy who wrote off last Sunday, or some people, I think, unfairly write off as being simply a cynic or a doubter. Thomas is ready to go take things on. "Let's go. We're going to die. We've got to die. Let's go." You'd expect Peter to say that, because Peter was one of those walking over the earth with his foot in his mouth occasionally. But Thomas is ready to go, okay? Well, that's one of the things sometimes we like to do with death, too. We can't, because death happens. The strategy now. degrees outside. And Trinity, I don't think, yet has air conditioning. They didn't then. And Sam Goldman was a pastor there. He was on vacation. I said, thanks a lot, Sam, for us. I'll be glad to cover for you. But I got there. I've been thinking it was really comical. I walked into the church, and I talked to the guy who invited me to funeral, which at that time had wonderful pastoral understandings of dealing with people. And one of the guys, Richard, said to me, do you think this is going to be okay? And I said, why? You know, because of the temperature of the body? And he started laughing. I was thinking in terms of Lazarus, he's been no body there, and it's too hot and all. Richard laughed and said, no, Pastor. So I was more worried about the people who are breathing. You know, if they come in, are they going to be able to stand it inside the church? And I said, don't worry, we'll be breathing and go on from there. Anyway, Roman territory too. What are the customs around death when the people are dead and dying? Dead or dying. In some areas of the country, there is no such thing as funeral visitation. They just don't do that. In others, the service is almost never held in the church for whatever reason, cultural reasons. In still others, the service is always held in the church. In every place that I've ever been, Lutherans always send food. Instead, do you believe this? with Mary. Mary doesn't come out. She's inside breathing. She doesn't go out to meet Jesus. The Jew in the river, and then when they tell her that he's there, she gets up and goes out to eat. Mary falls at Jesus' feet, verse 32. That also fits with her sitting quietly while Martha's running around making sure the pot roast doesn't burn. And then what does Mary say? Out of character with Mary, isn't it? Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then you say, well, what happened? Why did she say that? Why didn't she come out saying, Lord, we're sad that we know you're the one who's to come. After all, I've chosen the good thing. Glad you're here. Let's celebrate in sadness and in hope. Mary is the type who knows how to worship, but is overwhelmed by sometimes those who faith are. When something hits them so hard that they don't know what to do. When people, you know, get overwhelming sadness and they're left, even in the midst of their faith, wondering why in the world has this happened? They need to be lifted when all seems lost. After Jesus' resurrection, remember the other Mary Magdalene at the tomb? Remember what's going on there? She shows up, and of course Jesus is gone. And she really starts not just weeping, she's hysterically weeping. And have you ever done that to the point where, you know, your eyes are blurry, your nose is full, and, you know, you're just overwhelmed, you're crying so hard you can't stand anything. You know, you just really don't even know what's going on. And what is Jesus, what's Jesus going to do to bring her out of that? He doesn't come up saying, ta-da, surprise! He doesn't come up and say, I told you so. What does he do? Should I remember? One word. Yeah, it's going to cut through Mary. She's so loaded over, couldn't recognize me, you know, and all that stuff. Anybody who's cried so hard, you can't see straight. That's it, I know. But he doesn't, this is not a time for theological dissertation. It's time when Jesus says one word that she's going to hear. She's heard it before. With this Mary, Jesus does not again say, just as I told you. Didn't I tell you, Mary, he could have said, you've chosen the good thing, what happened to your faith? Don't you remember? We talked about this while your sister Martha didn't seem to get it. He could have said, you know, hey, I told you all that, we've covered all that, been there, done that. Don't you remember? He says none of that. But what does he do? He goes and gets angry, troubled in spirit, or disturbed in spirit, deeply moved, and says, where is he? Where did he lay him? And he's so engaged here that he begins to cry. That's why he's there. He's angry, he's upset, not at Mary and Martha, but upset at what he has seen the powers of darkness can do. When death in the future is afraid, death's mightiest powers have done their worst. And anyone who has known what it is to be broken by grief and sadness cannot help but feel upset. The funeral of a young mom in Virginia who was run over by her own car. She stopped at home, her driveway was an incline going down. She stopped inside the incline, got out to pick up a newspaper that was delivered after she had taken her son to school, and something malfunctioned in the car, and while she was in front of it, the car rolled down the hill, dragged her underneath into her backyard. And despite medevac to the local hospital, she died on the way to the hospital, leaving a seventh-grade son and a host of other folks just circling around, wondering why this person ever deserved for that to happen. And come into that feeling, the gastronomical upset that people do when they're just torn apart by what has occurred. That's what Jesus is doing. Marge asked me if her condition worsened than people were, as I said, staying with her. She said, Pastor, I can't get out much, but I don't want just anybody to be here with me. And I said, well, why not? Well, she's a problem for me. And she said, I'm really sorry about that, but it would be a problem for me if they, wanting to be well-meaning and helpful, were here with me. And I said, I understand. I said, who is your best friend? Well, she said, I don't want to offend anybody, you know, which is reasonable too. And I said, well, who's your best friend? And she identified Kay, someone she had known for 25 years. And I said, you and Kay get together. Yeah, she said, she's my buddy. We talk about anything. people of your community you want to be with you, and then Kay is the gatekeeper. She can schedule them 8 hours, roughly 8 hours, overnight, daytime, and all that, and then you can work it that way, and so that's what we did. And the people who were there, you know, were invited in, you know, where Marge was, to care for her in her last months and weeks. The next thing that happens is the encounter with death. Before you look, be prepared for what you might see. Jesus is still disturbed. Oh, and you know, before you, I think you had a page turn there. And you know, the last thing of the previous thing, the last enemy. We see something which is going to come later already. There's a twofold reaction to Jesus weeping. The first one, see how he loves it. Second one, see it? Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? That last verse was a funeral text at the funeral of a suicide within the last year. No warning, no loss, no nothing. Took a pistol and ended his life. And people in the congregation were flailing around saying, what could we have done? This passage speaks to that, to the helplessness that people have. The other thing that is absolutely necessary is in the case of suicide or death to preach a funeral sermon, believe it or not, that talks about death instead of just some sort of pastoral or pious platitudes. Now, go on to encounter with death. Be prepared for what you may see. Mark kind of slips back into character. Jesus says, take away the stone. Martha, says, hey, there's a problem here. There's an odor. He's been dead 4 days. And look at it. Now Jesus is beginning to go into almost as he told you. Did I not, he says to Martha, tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God? The key contact points for people to encounter folks that are in suffering or in that are dying. If surgery is involved, you see them before surgery, closely before surgery, just to talk with them about that. You see them afterwards, sometimes when they're half fogged from anesthetic, because at least they know that you have been there. You maintain the normal rhythm of contact with folks. I remember one person who told me about a Catholic person of another church. She said she knew that she was in trouble. She knew that she was going to die. It was one of our neighbors. Because her priest, it was a very large parish, well over 2,000-3,000 members. The priest never came to see her much in the hospital occasionally, but then he started stopping by every day. But no one had told her yet that she was terminally ill. And she said that these people think that I just got off a boat from somewhere. something is wrong. And finally, they caught up to what she already knew. Another key time to be with them, and this is a reminiscent of John 11, is to be, and I always try to do this, I try to be with the family at the family time, the first time that they view the body of one who has died. And just to be there, to be fully present and available, to see it all happen, sometimes rage, sometimes sadness, sometimes relief if it's been a long and painful illness. But to be there, you know, like with Mary and Martha at the tomb, and just to be helpful. What every servant should know, the stone's removed. Jesus looks upward and says, Father, thanks. I know you hear me. I've said this for the sake of the crowd standing here so that they may believe that you sent me. Have we seen any of these gestures before in Jesus' ministry? Looking up to heaven, thanking, in the feedings, remember, taking the bread, saying thanks, distributing. The constant contact Jesus has with his heavenly Father. At Emmaus, after Jesus' resurrection, when will they recognize the risen Lord? In the breaking of the bread. Remember, they don't, the Bible story, you know that, it runs them through the whole history, and then he sits down and suffers, and he takes the bread, gives thanks, and breaks it, and they do it. They've seen it before. The rhythm, familiar rhythm of Eucharist at Redeemer, we have communion, or the Lord's Supper, at every Sunday service. We don't usually do it Ash Wednesday, we do it on Monday, Thursday, but not ordinarily during Advent and Lent and the evening services, but the congregation made a conscious decision years ago to do that. And that is the rhythm of parish life now. And where I find that helpful is when people are hospitalized, something doesn't happen, which happened to me 10 or 15 years ago. I happened to be in the hospital communing someone who had asked for it, and I wandered into another member that was there, and I had my communion kit under my arm, and we visited, and I asked her whether she'd like communion, and she turned pale, and we went through it and all that, and then finally, you know, I said, well, you know, something wrong, and she said, am I going to die? Customs in that area had put the Lord's Supper kind of next, I would call it in my most cynical times, the Lutheran version of the Last Rites. You know, the symbol of it was that if you commune someone whose practice was not every service communion or every week communion, and I'm not demeaning this, but who grew from the custom of saying it is a sacred thing to be done monthly, maybe twice a month, and then you interject that into a kind of a rhythm that's not part of their world, you need to talk about that, and we did. Now, another object lesson. This struck me again. I always thought the reason Jesus went to Lazarus' tomb was to get it alive. Do you see what the resurrection of Lazarus is? It's an object lesson. So that, as Jesus has said, they may believe that you sent me. Remember the paralytic in Matthew 9 that Jesus heals. And he gets into this big theological debate about forgiveness of sins and how man can forgive sins and all that stuff. And Jesus cuts them short and says, now, so that you might believe. Then he says to the paralytic, get up and walk. And this guy, of course, gets up and goes home. Here, he says then, he shouts with a loud voice. The word for crying in a loud voice is used 8 times in the Gospels, 4 times by the crowds that are also shouting for Jesus' crucifixion. We couldn't go 2 years ago when I was in the Holy Land. We couldn't go to where it is, the guys always say, where it is believed that Lazarus was buried. They had a bus bombing there 2 days earlier, and the guys thought it wouldn't be a good idea for us to go there, and he agreed. But he said the tomb they have there has 28 steps from earth level down inside. And it's interesting, he said it would be very difficult for mobility challenged folks to get down there. And I laughed. I said, well, I'm as clumsy as they come. I'm mobility challenged, even if I look so young, as Jim says. But we didn't go there, but I thought the image I had was a tomb of 28 steps down, and then Lazarus coming out, and he's still bound up, you know. Got the thing over his face, he's all swaddled up and all, and not only does he make it out, but then Jesus, in some sort of comedic response, has to say the obvious, why didn't you turn the guy loose? And he's standing there, responding to Jesus' call. And by the way, he brings his clothes out because Lazarus is going to need them again. When Jesus rises, where are the grave clothes? You're left behind, folded. He will have no further use. Now, there are consequences. Consequences of pastoral care. You would think that this would be a stunner, that people would have said, wow, you are, in the words of Mary, the Messiah, who is coming into the world. I take you back to Temptation Mountain. And what did Satan suggest to the most religious of the temptations? Jump off the pinnacle. Have you ever had an object lesson like that in your church? Children's sermon? Leaping off the pinnacle of the temple? That'll get people's attention, right? And what does Jesus say? Not in my destiny. Here, you see that played out. Because bringing one back from the dead ought to call people to faith. And it does happen. Some of the Jews come with Mary, they see what Jesus did, and they believe in him. The most powerful invitation to Jesus comes, as we know, through those who know him. Yet sometimes when people deal with folks that are in the last stages of life, or they worry about using this moment as a chance to call people to faith, what comes up is the same fear I hear with folks that train for evangelism, the ones that never, they take the class, but never really want to do it. Down deep inside, I fear that somehow, because our culture is this way, they're afraid they can't make the sale. What if I go out and present and nobody comes?
consequence of this pastoral care is fear. What kind of fear happens? What are we to do? If we let it go on like this, the Pharisees say, everyone will believe in him. They heard part of what Jesus is about, so that everyone might believe. And what happens, and this can be done as you talk about folks in the midst of dying situations, like it or not, death tells us that the time comes when we lose our worldly goods, where we discover the limits of earthly security, of seeing only Jesus' signs, his power, as yet another marketing strategy. The Romans will come and, look at this, destroy both our holy place and our nation. Whose holy place is it? I always feel sad on Christmas Eve. Not because the power and majesty of that moment has jaded over the years. That's not the issue. But I always feel sad during the closing hymn when I see folk who have filled the church on their way out, during Joy of the World, the Lord has come. As if the closing credits of the film have kind of kicked in, and they want to get to the parking lot before the after-theater crowd. You always encounter those, and you especially encounter them at services of Christian burial and at services of Christian marriage. People, and you've seen them, that are almost physically uncomfortable with being in a church sanctuary. They tell you by their body language they really haven't been there much. And the task and the challenge of being able to communicate to them in a powerful, direct, and winsome way that they are in not our holy place, not Zion's church, not some place that is the result of all too often what someone has called edifice complexes in the church. But a holy place that says the goal of this is that we might believe in him. Foresight is the next one. It really should be prophecy, but I have to apologize. I wanted to stick with four F's here, and I couldn't spell prophecy with an F. It would make it feel better. You could say prophecy, but spell it F-P-R-O-P-H-E-C-Y. Here's K of this. And this is wonderful. It really is. You know, he says a true word and he has absolutely no idea what he's saying. And what is nice about that is that when most of us are in a situation not knowing what to say, we have a way of knowing that the Lord somehow uses our presence, our words, and our love to make sure that his message gets through. The people who stayed with Mara said, Pastor, I don't know what to say to her. I said, well, then don't say anything. Well, we have to do something. It's quiet. I said, well, is she worried about that? Well, no. Do you talk about something? Well, from time to time, we'll talk about all sorts of things. But then they said, what we're really scared of, Pastor, is that she's going to die while I'm with her. And I said, she might. And others said, you know, I'm with her and we have this special time together. But then I just go down to my car and I cry my eyes out before I can drive. I said, that's part of it too. In fact, one of them said, we sometimes just cry together. And you're transported back to Mary and Jesus at Lazarus' tomb. Because that's community too. It is not a part for Christians to have a stiff upper lip vis-a-vis someone who's overcome by grief. As our opening commentary said, we grieve not of those who have no hope, but who know that Jesus died. Fulfillment. Well, first of all, Caiaphas says, that's what it's going to be. You know, Jesus is going to die for the nation, not for the nation, to gather into one, the dispersed children of God. He couldn't know this, but that's exactly what Jesus would be asking for in his high priestly prayer, John 17. Father, I pray that all people might be one. Then there's fulfillment. Jesus kind of curtails his activities. He sticks around with the disciples. But the rhythm of the Passover is coming. The crowds are gathering, trying to get a hotel room in Jerusalem would be like trying to get one in Washington the week of the inaugural. And then the question is asked in verse 56, what do you think? Surely he will not come to the festival, will he? Well, which festival are they talking about? Yeah, they're talking about Passover. when Jesus arrives, which festival is he coming for? He arrives for that, prepares the Passover, and leaves the New Covenant, New Testament, Holy Thursday, departs on Good Friday, returns on Easter Sunday, and the church has never been the same. The last time I talked to Marge was before I left for a pastoral conference. And we had a good visit, gave her Holy Communion, and she was getting more and more tired, although she was so grateful that she had very little pain. The hospice people that took care of her, one day I was leaving, and they said, "Can we talk to you for a while?" We stepped out into another room where Marge couldn't hear us. And the hospice people looked at me and said, "What kind of congregation do you have?" And she didn't say it critically. I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "I've never seen a congregation that has had the kind of systematic contact around the clock with other people dropping by, not just the primary companions, but other people dropping by on a regular basis." She said, "We have never seen anything like that, ever." And I said, "Well, thank you. But I said, I think it is really just a sign of what we're trying to do as Christian people, knowing that death is part of life, but that death is not the end of the story." Anyway, I talked with Marge, and I said, "You know, I feel badly, Marge, because I've got to leave. I'm going to pastoral conference." And we had planned her funeral a time or two before, hymns, message, and all that. And she said to me, "I'm not going to tell you what to say, but," she said, "you know, these texts will be helpful." And so we put all that together, and I said to her, "You know, Marge and I are going to leave for pastoral conference, and we have a couple of days we'd like to take after for vacation." And she said, "Go on vacation." She said, you not only deserve the conference, but you need the rest." And she said, "Besides, if I'm not here when you come back, you'll know where I am." And I got the call from pastoral conference that she had died. And a couple of phone calls, and people there knew her from the region. And a couple of phone calls, I returned and sat down at my place. And four brother clergy said, "Aren't you going home?" I said, "Well, yes, we've got a conference and a couple of days vacation, and then we'll go home." And one of them said to me, "What kind of pastor are you?" He could not know that what had transpired here was a community embracing someone who knew what was set. The plans were made, the family was dispersed, and they would have together, it would take days. They could not know that my sitting there was not as one who was cold, aloof, and distant, but someone who was singing a song of victory, even as I tried to listen to what was being presented there. One final story, if you can give me another minute. When I was a kid, I used to say when I was small, but I was never small. When I was young, my parents used to take me, I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and my parents used to take me, literally take me and my sisters to Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor to listen to the annual rendition of the University Choral Union's Messiah. Wonderful thing, 300 or 400 member chorus, big orchestra, and from when I was very young, they started taking us, and I absolutely hated it. I really did. Couldn't stand it. You know, I would have rather gone to the doctor for my shots than go to that, but I had to go. You know, that was what was done. And I, like some kids today, would take the little piece of paper they gave you, they just printed the little libretto of what Handel's thing is, and I X off the parts as we laboriously go through, you know, things. But what really got me is that with some of the recitatives, and the guy had finished singing, and I'd be ready to go on, and he'd lean back and start singing it again, because there was more. But anyway, you know, this really went on annually, and I got there one year, and I remembered, well, I one of the songs I did like, because it was toward the end, was "I Know That My Redeemer Liveth." And there was this glorious, glorious, I forgot, is that a contralto or a soprano that sang that? I
was in
Okay. We have a musician. Anyway, she just soaring, and when she got up to sing, she walked oddly. But, you know, she had a long flowing gown on, young lady. And she soared through this thing, "Yet from my flesh shall I see God." And she turned, and when she turned, her dress swirled, and I saw the grace on her leg. And it dawned on me, you know, handicaps, signs of that back then, were really not dumb, or probably not even that okay, but she was a polio victim, and was there singing her heart out. And I captured in that moment, I discovered it now, but I captured it then, that maybe she knew something that the rest of us are just beginning to know.